Hello, you're tuning in to Guacamole, a collaborative podcast series on food by The Slow Press and Neighbor. In each episode, we dive into what lies beyond the stated necessities of a recipe, giving rise to the exploration of the stories and experiences shared by a new guest from the local culinary scene in Singapore. Scraps is the one word that we want to discuss and take inspiration from in this series. For me, it reminds me of the lesser used parts of ingredients, like the husk of corn, the tough, fibrous bits of vegetables, the fats we render from an animal, the bones that we usually discard without a second thought. Slowly, through my own exploration while tasting different kinds of food cooked by family or in restaurants, and picking up cooking at home, I've realized that these parts that we commonly disregard and discard can add another dimension of flavor to things that we cook. I am your host, Christy, and today we'll be inviting our guest, Keith Chiu. He will be sharing about scraps through a duck-themed menu he created earlier this year at Magic Square. He stepped into the culinary world at the young age of 17, having worked at establishments including Zen and Magic Square. He also started his own Donabe takeaway and delivery business called Isho, which he ran in 2022 until COVID restrictions were lifted. Now, he is 23, and he is serving the role of chef de partie at the impressive Japanese couple-style fine dining restaurant, Asora. Hello, Keith. Welcome on to the podcast today. So what do you have for lunch?
I had sushi at Genki today. It was okay.
Really, Genki?
Yeah, Genki.
Yeah, it's been a while since we last met. I think last we saw each other was at Magic Square.
Yeah.
When you were running the menu all about duck.
Yeah.
So like that menu really intrigued me because you used like duck brains and like duck liver and all sorts of like other parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like super fascinated by it. So like, maybe you can start off sharing about like why duck in the first place.
Okay, so I was tasked by my boss back then to create a second menu for Magic Square. So the theme for the menu was imposed by him, was to do a only skewer menu. So when I think of skewers, like the first thing comes to mind is yakitori. And when you look at yakitori, it's always mostly about chicken or, you know, pork. And I wanted to do something different, so I chose duck instead because quite similar to chicken, but it's harder to cook. And when you, and I realized why it was not done in yakitori, because the amount of fat the duck has is crazy and it flares up. So to cook like 24 sticks at one go, it's quite crazy for 24 packs. And quickly, I had to think about ways to manipulate the duck itself to make it easier for myself and my team to cook for so many people.
Yeah. Right. So like, imagine if you do a duck at yakitori, would there be like a lot of wastage?
I don't think so. As long as you plan how you want to use it, because I had to create a 9-course menu. So I used almost everything and except the neck itself, because it was quite dirty and I didn't have the manpower to, you know, clean it out for the guest itself. Yeah.
Right. So how do you like study the different parts of the duck?
So it was a lot about trial and error. Some of the things I did made me go to the toilet by using like duck brains. So I had duck brains raw. That was quite crazy. All I did was add a little bit of soy sauce, like sashimi, and then just eat it. I didn't feel very good for the next few days. So I broke down different parts of the duck. So we had the head, the wings, the legs, the breasts, fillets, the eyes, the tongue, the beaks, and everything all out. And I look at things in a very different perspective. So when you, for example, I made a duck beak syrup. So when you look at duck beaks, they actually have a lot of fat all around the beaks itself. And when I thought of like, why don't I make it to a dessert? So when you make caramel, it's always about butter, sugar, and cream. And same thing with butter, it's fat, right? So I try to use the fat around the beak itself to create a caramel. It failed. And it became a syrup instead, which is quite crazy because it tastes like lemon barley. So from there, I got a little bit too hyped and went a little bit further and create different things. The ice, I use it like fish ice, like gelatin, to create a jam, a grapefruit jam with the ice. And then I tried different stuff and you went on from there. Yeah.
Right. So like just now you mentioned you went to the toilet and everything.
Yeah.
As a chef, how do you determine if something's like safe to eat, or like you just try and you like die later and figure out?
I think it's more about your knowledge, and sometimes when I'm not too sure about something, I'll always ask my senior chefs or the people around me, or I would use myself as a guinea pig and try, you know, like small amounts, small traces, and then make sure everything's okay and before I serve it to guests, obviously. Or I will even Google it. Yeah.
So like, how do you determine like what kind of flavors to like pair with each part?
I think if when you look at the duck itself, different parts have different doneness and different textures as well, and different textures complements with different flavors. And if you have something more, for example, duck breast, it's a little bit more gamey, a little bit more strong in flavor just with salt, right? And you want to pair with something also equally heavy or something more bright, citrusy as well. That's why you have things like duck à l'orange, which is like an orange-based sauce with duck breast itself. So it's more about how you pair with different parts and textures of the duck itself. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's so cool. Then maybe you can tell me more about like the different cooking methods you use. Like just now you said yakitori, right?
Yeah.
So that's mainly like grilled, but I'm sure your menu has just more than that.
Yeah. So let's go from the head first. So we had duck tang. So duck tang, I know it's quite commonly used in Hong Kong and Taiwan when they braise it. So what I did was to make a braise, the braise liquid, but reduce it down into a tare almost, something similar to Japanese. And then I will just brush it off and then grill it over charcoal. And then we have the skin all around the duck itself. So the skin, I made it into a chip, dehydrated it, and then mix it with a little bit of tapioca starch to make a very nice crisp. To pair with a salad, and then we have the duck breast itself. So duck breast is commonly cooked on the pan in French methods, and it's quite dry. So I had to create a method that could make it more juicy. So obviously, as a chef, you would think you want to brine it. But when you brine something, it creates a lot of water content in the duck breast itself, which makes it, which makes the skin not as crispy. And it makes it quite moist as well, which isn't really what you really want from a duck breast, because you want a little bit of dryness to give it some texture. So what I did was to mince it up, make it into a sukune, which is a Japanese term for meatball. So we made it into a little meatball stuffed with a little bit of anchovies as well to give it some umami. And then the fillet itself, we separated it. So we have this thing called shiokoji, which is Japanese fermented rice that we use to marinate meats to make it a little bit more tender, more flavorful. So with that idea, I use our local rice and beans to make a koji, our localized version of koji instead of like Japanese ones. And it came out great, actually. It's quite nice. Alcoholic, a little bit more bitter, but also sweet. So that was used to marinate the duck breast to give it more juiciness. And then we have, what else? We have the duck legs. We made it into because it's a skewer-based menu. So I played around with the word skewer and used the duck leg as a whole, so you can grab the whole legs to eat it.
Ah, that's okay.
Yeah, so that was something that triggered my boss a lot, because I played around with his words. so I got in on that. So
he's not listening.
Yeah. And then the duck feet itself, which was something that I failed so badly, because I wanted to make it something that you can eat off like a pork crackling almost.
Like a chicken feet kind of thing?
No, it's more like roast pork, right? The skin on the roast pork. But I want to do that for the duck legs itself. But that didn't came out so well. And then, the nails. So the nails was inside the meatball itself.
Eat the nails?
Yeah, you can. So you just got to boil it out and it becomes collagen almost. And then you edit the meatball so it's a little bit more crunchy. Yeah, so something that was quite interesting for me. Yeah.
I've never heard of anyone like consuming the nails of any...
No,
like,
no.
Like some people don't even want to eat like fish skin at all.
Yeah, fish skin, tongue, you know, something like this. Yeah.
So like just now you mentioned a lot about like Japanese cooking methods and stuff. And like because Magic Square is like for Singaporean chefs to like explore Singaporean flavors. So would you say like maybe like half of your background kind of like contributes to the Japanese influences?
Yeah, obviously. So with my team at Magic Square, we still always use local ingredients with Japanese influence and Chinese techniques. Because I'm very fond in about using both techniques, Chinese and Japanese, and how it can merge. Because when you look at miso, miso in Japanese culture is very common. And we have our localized version, which is doubanjiang, or your black bean paste, right? And the funny thing is that miso costs more than black bean paste.
Why is that so?
So the reason for that is because Japanese have very controlled and stringent ways to control miso, while Singaporeans and around China and Taiwan, it's done by farmers, right? Mm. They have an open space, not really controlled very well as well. And Japanese price miso a lot, and they will do it, like they go all out to make it like wonderful because it's their own family recipe, right? So for us in our Chinese context, it's not as an ingredient that's found it's quite common. Yeah.
Right. So you would say like miso is a lot more like elevated.
Yeah,
like
this correct.
Specialty miso even.
Yeah,
right?
Correct. Yeah.
Damn, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But like for Chinese, like soy sauce is like so versatile and like they're like cheap, right? Like,
yeah.
Accessible.
Yeah.
And it's quite different from like how the Japanese would do it.
Yes, obviously. Yeah. Yeah.
So like, I'm just curious, but like, what's the main difference between like the Japanese shoyu and the Chinese soy sauce?
So Japanese shoyu, it's divided into three actually. So you have white soy sauce, it's called shiro shoyu, and then you have yuzukuchi and koikuchi. So yuzukuchi is light soy sauce and koikuchi is dark soy sauce.
Mm.
But it's not like the local dark soy sauce that we have, the very thick one that you use for chicken rice. It's more umami, it's more stronger in taste. And actually Japanese have more soy sauce than this three, but these three are the main ones. And our Chinese soy sauce, there are a lot of MSG in it.
Oh.
Yeah. So I have a friend who creates soy sauce. I'm not going to name his company because he will kill me. he does a lot of soy sauce with different grades. And with each grade, he adds a little bit more MSG to it to give it more flavor. But whereas, yeah.
It's a scam.
That's like when you go eat your fish soup, right? You have soy sauce, right? And that soy sauce is so different from the one you have at home. Because there's a lot of MSG in it. And the one in Japan, it's more clean, it's more savory, it's more umami, it's pure goodness. That's why when you go to Japanese restaurants, they brush that soy sauce over the fish. It's always very nice because it's very clean tasting. Yeah.
Just now when you mentioned the three different like shoyus, I haven't even tried like the different varieties.
Really?
Before.
Yeah.
Unless it's been, when it's mixed in, definitely. But on its own, I don't think it's like a household product for like Singaporeans to cook with.
Yes, it's usually found in like restaurants. Right. Yeah.
So on the topic of like ingredients, how do you like, where do you source your ingredients from for the menu?
For Magic Square, I try to use as much local ingredients as I can, or all around the region, near Singapore. It could be from Taiwan, Hong Kong, or even Japan as well. And I try to use fish from Japan because it's much cleaner, it's much nicer as well compared to the ones that we have around Singapore. Because our fish comes from Indonesia, you know, from Batam, things like this. And the waters are a little bit warmer, which helps. Mm. It doesn't really help the fish to thrive because it's not as fatty. Mm. And whereas in Japan, it's colder, the waters are colder, the fish builds up a little bit more fat. So it's kind of nicer that way. Yeah.
Right, then what about like the accompanying ingredients that went into the menu? Like, I think for the duck leg, you guys made like a rempa.
Yeah, so that was sambal ulek. So it's a ginger flower-based sambal, very fragrant as well. I try to use ingredients that people would not think of using in the sambal. So usually people use belacan to make sambal, belacan sambal. And then I try to use ginger flower. But the tough thing was, ginger flower oxidizes when you cook. It turns black.
Oh.
So what can I do to preserve the color itself and the taste? And that's where like my experience from Restaurant Zen comes in about preserving things, pickling or even fermenting. So I pickled ginger flowers to preserve the color before making it to a sambal. So I think that was something interesting that I did. Yeah.
Mm. When it comes to the term sambal, right?
Yeah.
How would you like explain it to somebody who never like cooked before?
I think sambal is a very fake term for chili paste almost, right? Because you have it in Indonesia, you have it in Malaysia, Singapore, everybody has their own version of sambal.
Yeah.
But to conclude, what sambal is to me is a base of using four ingredients, chili, garlic, onion, and belacan.
Mm.
So this four creates sambal to me. Yeah.
That's very nice. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when I was in Malaysia last year, right?
Yeah.
All the Malaysians keep asking me like, is like Singaporean food better or Malaysian food? Then they are like pressuring me to say that like Malaysian is better because it's like more flavorful and like the chili is spicier and everything.
Yeah.
And I just agree somehow.
Because I feel like with, I'm asked that question, right? I will always ask them back is that everybody has their own palate, right? Everybody tastes things differently. To me, it's salty. To you, it may be very salty, you know? Mm. So it's quite interesting. So I would say that food is really, really subjective.
Mm.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong. That's why people go to restaurants, Michelin-star restaurants, because the chefs aren't afraid to create things that they like, you know?
Right.
And then why people go back to the same restaurant is because you vibe with the restaurant, you like the restaurant, and you have similar interests. Yeah.
And also because you started like in the culinary scene from like a young age.
Yeah.
And like you are just like a year younger than me.
Yeah.
And like your friends will be like around the same demographic as my friends, I assume.
Yeah.
And like most of my friends aren't like exposed to like fine dining, or they won't even like want to pay for a meal like above $100. Mm-hmm. So like how do you like talk about your time at Magic Square with like your non-chef friends?
I would say that my friends understand like what I do, and I try to educate them with dinners that I host weekly with them. So I do like a small potluck with them.
Oh, so cute.
Yeah, so this is something fun I always do with my friends, and like try to like show them things that they have not seen before, and like the joys of sourcing ingredients in Singapore. Mm-hmm. So we'll do like mini market tours with them, you know, we'll do it occasionally, and then I'll like do a fun little thing. I'll ask them to choose an ingredient each, and I'll try to create something. So for me as a chef, it's like a challenge for myself to create things out of the box. And it's for them to, you know, it's a way that we bridge our two, you know, different worlds together. Yeah.
What are some things that they have tried cooking and you laughed at them for?
I think like the most simple thing that they like to cook is steak, right?
Mm.
And steak is something that it's not...
I don't think it's simple at all.
it's not easy to get right.
Yeah.
And that's why they bought a sous vide machine after me, you know, shitting on them. so it's a thing that I would say is a skill that every chef has to know. And I'll try to teach them, you know, like how you can get like a very nice crust, juicy texture and things like that. But the most important thing is sourcing of ingredients.
Mm.
If you're going to get a very lean piece of beef, you will not get the kind of like very chewy, mouth-watering kind of mouthfeel. So it's like when you buy beef, it's always the nice proportion of fat and lean meat.
Mm.
Yeah.
Then usually when you cook at home, do you cook at home actually?
Actually, no, I don't really cook at home. The funny thing is cooking at a restaurant is really tiring as well.
It is, yeah.
And then I hate to clean up, you know. Imagine doing it at home after cooking a steak. Right. It's quite crazy to clean up because of the oil spills. And then what I do is I'll try to cook at the restaurants, pack it nicely, bring it home, put it in the microwave. Yeah, that's an easier way of handling things. Yeah. Sort of like meal prep almost. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So it's like really an application of all parts of like real life.
Yeah.
And like applying it in the restaurant even.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was like your favorite dish from the menu going back to that? Yeah.
I would say my favorite dish was actually the dessert. The dessert was something that I'm still quite mind blown about it and how I managed to do it as well. The ideas came when I'm in the toilet showering. That's when you're the most relaxed. And
I do agree.
Yeah. So the dessert was based on beer papa. So you have a shoe puff, right? So I did a dark fat shoe puff with a grapefruit jam using the ice and a cured duck head ice cream.
Mm.
So the idea came about because I read about a chef who created a bacon ice cream. Mm. And I was quite intrigued in why can't I do it something similar to that and treat duck head as a charcuterie.
Mm.
So if you cure duck heads and then you confit them and you dry them out, it tastes like very nice, in Chinese called bahu, you know. So it's quite interesting. So with that in mind, I tried to create it into an ice cream and it turned out wonderfully well. And then I made it into a shoe puff where you can assemble it together. So they get the guests to spread the jam on the true path, a little bit of the duck beak syrup. Yeah, have the ice cream. Yeah.
How does the duck eye taste like?
Duck eyes taste horrible.
Oh, shit.
It's quite bitter, but I did that because grapefruit is already bitter and slightly sweet. Mm-hmm. So that is to amplify the bitterness, because when you end off a meal, you want something like citrusy, not too strong. But I didn't care. I went all out because it's the whole duck menu. So that's why I did. Yeah.
I think it's a really nice ending to the menu.
Yeah,
like,
thank
it's
you.
The most unexpected thing ever.
Yeah.
And when you showed us like the pot of all the duck beaks, we're like, oh, yeah. That's what we just ate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
We are done with this part of the podcast and we'll pass the time on to Kevin.
Okay, so what you just shared about what you did to the poor duck is really horrifying.
Okay.
Because before the start of this episode and before looking into it, I would have never considered duck brains, eyes, beaks, and all these different parts to be edible.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, what is the inception of that idea apart from your boss telling you to do that? Did you have inkling on wanting to do something like that before, or why duck? I have all these questions.
For me, when I went into this whole thing, I didn't have any prior experience about using whole animals to cook. It's always the common cuts, like your rib eye, your breast, your legs. And I wanted to challenge myself because I want to prove myself that I'm actually capable of what I do as a chef and where I've come from and why am I today? So I had a lot to prove on the table because at Magic Square, I was competing with other chefs. I would say competing because I want to be on the same level as them. So they come from very reputable restaurants like Odette, three-star restaurant. You came from Teva, 2 stars. And then myself, because they were all older than me. So I had a lot to prove. And I wanted to push myself so hard that I actually broke down because this menu was something that I put in a lot of effort and I'm glad that it turned out very well. So other than the challenge given by my boss, I wanted to really prove myself and how far I can push as a chef. Yeah.
What do you think is a takeaway that you have taken from start to finish of doing something like this? Because I can imagine, and this apart from the creative challenges, I think practically as well, you mentioned that you were just tasting different things just to get a sense, even however disgusting it might be, but you needed to get that baseline and you would be able to iterate from that. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is a takeaway that you've taken from this experience?
I think it's very important to be always open-minded to trying different things and thinking past what you already know. Yeah, it could be, for example, tasting the duck brains itself. Like, I know that it's wrong to taste raw brains.
Interesting.
I know. Yeah. But it can be done, right? Because when you look at sashimi, it's raw, you know? So why can't you do it with duck brains? Later, I found out it's because there's a lot of bacteria in the brains itself. And that's why you can't.
Yep.
But I didn't give a shit, you know? So I just sprinkle a little bit of salt because salt kills bacteria, right?
Yep.
In a way. Yep. So I did it. I didn't really kill the bacteria in the toilet, obviously. So it was something that I told myself to always be open and just try things. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Even like the nails also. The nails was quite weird. So I just pan fried the nails and then just ate it like this. And it was so crunchy. And I thought that, what if I break down the cell structures of the nails itself by boiling it out before cooking it? And then it turned out well. It turned out like crisp almost.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like quinoa, fried quinoa.
Yep.
Yeah.
The way I hear you describe about food in the section with Christy and even now, feels as though it feels like a science to you because there's always this dynamic and this tension between, oh, is cooking like an art form or like a science? Like there are certain steps to it. You have to measure, two cups of this or 2 tablespoons of that.
Yeah.
What has your experience been like for you personally? Is it more like a science or is it more like an art form or is it something else entirely?
I think it's not really about science. It's more about a art form almost. I think cooking is a very beautiful thing. And when you look at things in a different perspective, it kind of comes out in a very different way, how you approach different proteins, I would say. And then the science part comes in when you are doing things a little bit more serious in terms of fermentation. Fermentation can go horribly wrong if done wrongly. And there are also different guidelines that you should follow in terms of temperature, days to ferment, visualize the ingredient itself, because mold happens quite often. And if you do not recognize the correct molds, you'll get sick.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So in terms of color as well, how you store it in a dark place to create more mold, you store it in a warmer place to mitigate the mold growth as well. So all this comes into place when you do fermentation. So it's quite interesting for me.
Yep. Yeah. So going back to your feelings about the duck and using most of the parts of it, what is challenging to you now? Because I would imagine at a certain point in time, that was challenging to you.
Yeah.
So what is challenging to you now since you've done that?
Yeah, I think now it's more about going to a different protein. So now I'm handling a lot of fishes now at Asora. So looking at that now, breaking down different fish, different sizes, all have their own different bone structures, which is very interesting to me. Like kinky, right now I'm playing with kinky now. So kinky, it's a very fatty fish. So when you fillet, the fish releases a lot of oils and it's kind of like slippery.
Yeah.
So you have to manipulate the fish in a way that it keeps its fat in. So what I do is to store in the fridge. So I won't take out the whole batch of the fish out. I will store one by one in the fridge itself and fillet, put it in the fridge, fillet the fridge to hold their fat in. So that's something I learned at Asora, like how to manipulate fishes in a way that it's easier for me. Yeah. So I think that's one challenge I'm facing now. And then the other one is to fillet big fishes. We have a fish called buri. So buri is about as big as about almost a meter long.
Jesus.
Yeah. So it's a very big fish. So it's how you, because I'm just one person filleting a big fish and I have a very small knife. So how do I manipulate the fish? So what I learned is to break down different parts, the head, the body. So same thing like the dog. It's how you manipulate things to your own comfort. Yeah.
I find it interesting that you use the word protein to describe fish, because I would have never thought, for me, protein is more, I think of beef, I think of chicken, I think of pork, lamb, maybe. Yeah. I have never considered fish like a form of protein. Is this the way that you're taught to take a step back and not be so zoomed in on the animal, but the type of nutrients and the type of resource that these different things give?
Yeah, I think because what I know about fish and in terms of protein is that there's a famous chef called Josh Nyland. He's situated in Sydney. So he treats fish like meat. So why I say that is he dry ages fish.
Interesting.
Yeah, he breaks down fish in a way, for example, a swordfish. He breaks it down in a way that you have a ribeye almost. So he will leave the bone on the fillet itself, creating a ribeye structure compared to the actual beef kind of ribeye. So it's quite interesting how he makes, for example, there's this, what's that thing called? The one that you have in Spanish food, the one that layered meat called for your burritos. I forgot the term.
There's a term?
Yeah, there's a name for it. I forgot, but he does it similar to that. So he slices fishes nicely and then he'll stack it out on the skewer and then he will slow cook it. So it's quite interesting. So he treats fish like meat. So that was something I was so drawn into. And it's actually opening a restaurant in Singapore. So it's something that I plan to go and try to further my knowledge.
And in the pursuit of furthering knowledge, where does a chef like yourself gather inspiration from? You're staring at fishes, you're staring at all these different ingredients all day. Do you take a step outside of the kitchen to look for inspiration? Or is it from your peers?
So I had this conversation with my ex-boss, Ken Loon. So it's always easy to copy people's ideas because there's so many ideas. There's no such thing as the original idea because there's so many people who have already done it before me. So I think it's more about using provenance. Like, where can you find ingredients that no one has sourced before and create something really different? So instead of using like potato to make chips, why can't you do like Jerusalem artichoke chips? You know, it's very different. Yeah, it's a tuber. So it's a very interesting ingredient. So find things that people have not tried before and make it your own in a way. Yeah. So it's always easy to, how to say, take this, take that, and then make something you will feel like it's your own. But to me, it's more about finding that originality that no one has done before in a way that you find ingredients that it's so weird or something that everybody uses, but manipulated in a way that no one has seen it before.
Yep.
Yeah. Take a step back and then look at things differently.
Has there been a recent example that you have taken something unconventional or something people have slept on and you manipulated it to be a certain way? Because I find it interesting that I think you're the first guest or the first person who cooks that uses the word manipulate when you're talking about food, because it's usually not associated with cooking and the techniques of cooking. Yeah.
To be very frank, no. Ever since I left Magic Square, I left that aside for a while because I needed that mental break, because at Magic Square is very crazy and I wanted some time for myself. And the good thing is I'm going to start a pop-up soon, which I'll be focusing more on that again.
Yep.
And coming to my restaurant now, Asura, I have the time, my free time to do more experiments.
Mm.
And I'm going to do a particular dessert for Asura now. So that's something that I want to showcase how to manipulate different things. And this time around, I'm using fruits and how you can manipulate fruits in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought for a second you're going to say, I'm going to use the fish for desserts. No. I was holding my breath a little bit. I was like, fuck.
Yeah. So the funny thing is someone did that. So Josh Nyland did a cheesecake with fish. Yeah, he did a fish caramel. Yeah. I think it's not too bad,
Paint a picture. What's that like? Yeah.
It's a just think caramel with a hint of fishiness, but it's also quite sweet almost.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like your dried squid.
Fair.
But a sweeter version.
Okay.
So a chef, Jonathan Gunn, he is at Magic Square now. It's not called Focal. He does a fish sauce caramel, which is quite interesting also. So I call it like, got inspired by that also. He's doing things that no one has done before. So,
So, I have to ask, being a chef of your caliber, what, how much of it is pushing these established boundaries of different items, and how much of it is doing the usual day-to-day stuff? How much balance do you need to have to be creative as a chef and to still fulfill your duties, let's say, for service and stuff? Because I can imagine, if you are cooking in a restaurant, you're doing service, you're not being wildly experimental at times. You're always, in a sense, you have to prep and you have to prepare the same dishes from the menu. Yeah, how much of your time do you spend balance trying to be really creative and trying to combine different things and failing at it? And
I think it's a very natural feeling that it comes. Basically, I will look at seasons and different ingredients that they are prime at the moment. And let things flow naturally. I will never sit down and think about a particular thing that I want to do.
Mm.
It always comes naturally, whether I'm taking the bus to work or the train. Things just come.
When you're relaxed.
When I relax. Like why I sit in the toilet kind of thing. So that comes just naturally. Yeah. Yep. Or when I eat things and I taste different things by accident. Could be while drinking a lemon-flavored water, for example, and then tasting chili. Actually, that could make a very good combination, and that's how I'll jot it down in my note, and then I'll create something like this almost. Yeah.
So you work backwards from that experience, and you try to pull in different ingredients and different techniques just to recreate that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Almost, yeah.
Do you have a handle, or do you know, I guess, what your flavor profile is, or do you have a specific type of flavor profile? I ask because I would imagine certain people, or most people, have certain biases. They like certain things.
Yeah.
And they tend to create the things that they like instead of things that they actively dislike.
Okay.
What's your take? Do you have a certain type of flavor that you really like, you really enjoy? Or do you try to create more, I guess the only word I have right now is universally, like even things that you actively don't eat, don't like. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I like to create things that people don't like. Mm. I like things a little bit more funky, a little bit more sour. And these things sort of like messes it up with your tongue. Almost. So if you go to Zen and eat, it's like the third course and you can't feel your tongue. It's numb. So this is the kind of food that I like to create. But it's not a very good thing because you want to create a menu where people can consistently taste things, taste different flavors and not just get numb by the third course. So that was like my sinful thing I like to do. I like to create very umami flavored dishes, sour. I like to create mapo tofu, you know, very strong flavored things, which is not very good in a menu situation almost. Yep. Yeah. Like a course menu kind of thing. Yeah.
So I would imagine being, having worked in this establishment before, they also shown you another side where you have to be, I guess the word I have right now is considerate. You have to, dial down your own artistic intent, but you have to think from the perspective of the customer.
Yeah.
And you have to plan out the entire menu for them.
Definitely.
Yeah, because from what you were sharing about Zen, it sounds pretty insane.
Yeah,
it's like so many different dishes, different courses.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So if you were to plan some of that out, is it more like a journey you want to take the customer on? Where does the inception for something like that so extravagant begin?
So this is the fun thing about being a chef, is that you can create menus and with different teams, right? So like the duck menu was one. The another menu that I want to create something is more about like a journey. How you can go from like the sea to land kind of concept, or land to sea, or like a hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold kind of situation. There's so many things you can do and like spice things up. So for me, it's more about starting with something light.
Yeah,
heavy, and then finishing off with something more sweet and savory at the end. So that's kind of style that I like to do now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Interesting. I wanted to talk about your experience with regards to different processes and different cultures. Currently, you're working in a Japanese restaurant.
Yes.
What are some of your takeaways that you weren't aware of before you entered like the Japanese restaurant? Yeah.
So the way that they, I would say, they handle their ingredients, it's more meticulous, more delicate as well. They keep things very properly. And when the fishes come, they immediately fillet it and they keep it nicely. You know, they all wrapped it up in this Japanese paper that absorbs a lot of moisture, and then they'll just keep it in the fridge. Some restaurants, they'll like to age it. Some restaurants like to just leave it out for the whole day until they come to it or so, which is not right. Then coming to Asura, it's more about preserving the ingredient itself, how you can keep it as minimal as possible, but also showcasing the flavors of the ingredient itself. So every dish we have is always 4 to 5 ingredients almost. Some restaurants like Zen, I'm not speaking bad about them, but 16 ingredients, 16 different components almost. Yeah, so it's quite crazy.
Sounds insane, yeah?
Yeah. But at the end of the day, can you taste it? No, you can't. Yeah. For average Joe, not a chef, you can't really taste it.
Yep.
So coming to Asura, it helps me to keep myself constrained, minimal as possible, showcasing the ingredients of the particular season at its prime. So that's something that I try to inculcate with the kind of food I create now.
Yeah. And you mentioned seasonal.
Yeah.
So I would imagine sometimes there isn't this particular fish.
Yeah.
You will have to operate, or you have to utilize different fish altogether.
Yes, correct.
And because different fishes, they have different profiles.
Yeah.
You have to use different ingredients as well.
Correct.
Yeah. Would that mean that the menu is constantly changing as per the season as well?
Yes, correct. So right now, it's Asura. Asura is actually quite interesting because we follow the four seasons. Right now, we are focusing on autumn. So we in Singapore, there's no different seasons. So we try to bring that into Singapore by using different ingredients within that particular season. So right now in autumn, as the months passes by, things start to appear more. More ingredients becomes better. So right now we have matsutake mushrooms. Then as we progress, we have white truffles that's coming because winter is near. So we have white truffles coming in. So we always progress slowly with the seasons, and we change them constantly. Yeah. So every day it's a different day. And for example, a apple in February could taste very different than apple in July, for example.
So that is the confusing part. Like you just mentioned that. How, as your responsibility as a chef, how do you prepare the ingredients if you can't even rely on them tasting the same? Like it seems like the variable is so, it could be wildly different as well.
Yeah, that's a good question, because that's why we are chefs, right?
Fair.
That's why we are chefs. So we taste a lot, and we know a lot of different knowledges about different ingredients, and we accommodate to certain ingredients. So we will always base a dish on a particular main ingredient and work around it. Yeah. So for example, we want to do fish. So what can we pair with the fish itself, with the season changing almost? Yeah.
Interesting. So going back to the theme of this podcast, which is scraps.
Yeah.
What comes to mind when you see the word scraps, or you think about the word scraps?
For me, scraps is always things that people like discard, or they don't want it, or things that people deem not useful almost. So that to me is scraps almost. Yeah.
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 Do you see it as a challenge for yourself as a chef to utilize the entirety of, let's say, like a fish, the entirety of, let's say, like a cabbage or something like that, that you can use it from, you can use the entirety of it, and you're not just discarding away the parts that are unused?
So if you look into a fine restaurant, obviously we'll use the scraps in certain ways, but there are ingredients that we can't really use. You know, we are a restaurant, obviously we have to make money, But we also try to mitigate like what is usable, what it's not. And there's always waste. You can't really use everything. You can't use chicken feathers. What can you do with chicken feathers?
Like a dresser.
Yeah, you know. So in cooking, there are things that you have to discard. You really have no choice. But that's why like the Michelin guide, they created this thing called the Green Star. So this,
what's that?
So the Green Star is to award restaurants who create a restaurant that based on sustainability and being environmental friendly. So restaurants like this, we have one in Singapore. It's called Saroja. Mm. They just got their first Green Star in Singapore. They do a lot of things that help to be sustainable. So they use ingredients that's around the region, around Singapore, as close as possible because. Yep. If you get things from France,
you have to fly
you know, all these are caused emissions and stuff like this. So they try to use things as close as possible, which is good because why it's fresher that way, right? You can get things on the spot. It's easier. You support the local community, the farmers and stuff like this.
Yep.
So I think it's a very good takeaway. Yeah.
Do you feel that looking locally and putting the focus back on local ingredients within the region is... there is a lot more interest in that right now, as opposed to having certain ingredients that are a lot more overrated. The example that comes to mind is truffles. People always bring truffles because we have such an oversaturation of truffles that when encountered with the real thing, we might not even know that it's truffles because there's so much synthetic type of truffles and people use it liberally. Yeah.
So I feel like for me, I never use truffles in my food or caviar unless there's a need to, because restaurants usually use them to elevate and to justify the cost of the price that they are paying for.
How do you distinct that this dish needs caviar then?
So it's really on the chef itself. Some chefs like to create a caviar dish, like focusing on the caviar itself, which I think it's more appropriate that way rather than creating a dish and then adding caviar. I think it's a very different approach.
Yep.
Whereas you use caviar as a main ingredient and adding things to make caviar shine and pop.
I see.
Yeah. So that's my view on caviar in that way. Yeah.
In your opinion, is there a local ingredient that's being slept on?
Slept on.
Yeah.
I think people hate to use a lot of the local fishes that we have in Singapore. Other than our local scene, obviously.
Yeah.
And like I asked my Japanese chef, have you tried our local Spanish mackerel? He said, no, it tastes like crab. Because it's very lean, it's not fatty compared to the one in Japan. It's called sawara.
Mm.
So it's very, very different. And I feel like you can't justify a fish just by, because it's from around there's this stigma that our local fishes is not good, you know. But if you treat them nicely, treat them properly, like salt it and then add a little bit of sake, mirin, it can turn out very nice actually.
Yeah.
So one of the fishes that I really love is the Spanish mackerel that we have in Singapore, which my chef hates.
Yeah.
It's, if you confit them and add different flavors and different techniques to it, it can turn out very juicy and nice. So it's really how you as a chef manipulate the ingredients. Yeah.
So would it be safe to assume that you hold a belief that there's no bad ingredient? It's just how you want to treat it, manipulate it, and play around with it.
Yeah, from what I understand and from my experience, yes. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think my last question for you is, I'm curious to know, how has your perception of food, cooking, ingredients, being a chef, how has it changed across your journey?
I think when I was younger, I always taste things for the sake of tasting, like eating for the sake of eating, you know? But once I grew older, I found that I appreciate things more. I appreciate that the work that the chefs put in to create this wonderful plate of food. And I think as I grow older and I understand that food is just not just food, you know. Like I appreciate it a lot more because the farmers, that the effort they put in to create that particular product goes a long way.
Mm.
And I feel like with good food comes with good ingredients. It works hand in hand. And I feel as a chef now, I want to honor the farmers that they create such wonderful ingredients, and also the fishermen, obviously.
Yeah.
So moving forward, I want to keep things as minimal as possible, try to highlight the ingredients as a chef.
Yeah. It's interesting because I would imagine most for people consuming food, sometimes our experience of that or our thought of that just stops at the chef. Yeah. We don't think about where these ingredients are coming from. Yes. We don't think about the journey these ingredients took even get to the hands of the chef and then to our plate.
Yeah. Because if there's no ingredients, there's no chef, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
So I guess that's the weakness. If there's no ingredients, there's no chef.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, beautiful. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And that marks the end of our conversation with Keith today. Thank you for tuning in to the second episode of Guacamole, a short podcast series by The Slow Press and Neighbor. Remember to share it with your friends if it sparked your curiosity. We'll see you in a bit for the next episode. Goodbye.